I kind of always had the notion that I wanted to have children and a relationship with them and help them. I don't know, I just always was looking forward to having kids. And now that they are here, I still want to do things creatively, but like as important to me is developing them. Like to me, that is the most creative thing I do is working with them.
Welcome to the Dadwell Podcast. I'm your host, Antonio Garcia. Dadwell & Company is an independent media project at the intersection of creativity and fatherhood. The Dadwell Podcast features makers, artists, musicians, authors, filmmakers, and designers who are raising the creative bar while simultaneously raising small humans. Charlie Smith is my best friend. We've known each other for almost a quarter century, and our lives have run in this uncanny parallel ever since we met. Additionally, and in no particular order, Charlie is a director, designer, and educator. Charlie works in innovation consulting, combining motion design and video with human-centered methodologies to capture, interpret, and curate qualitative design research into concise, empathy-driven human stories that change hearts and minds. Charlie also teaches video storytelling at the Illinois Institute of Technology's Institute of Design, where he helps students sharpen their narrative video skills, shape audience-focused stories, and explore storyboarding, camera, and production workflows. Little known detail, Charlie is a closet sneakerhead. He got into the hobby as a way of intentionally doing something fun for himself after settling into fatherhood. As a designer, he's interested in the sneakers from a fashion and product design standpoint, but what he's more intrigued by is the psychology and commerce ecosystem surrounding it all. If you need help identifying dope kicks, he's your guy. This episode feels less like an interview and more like a phone call between best mates. We skip the formalities of the show and dive right into our parallel struggles and compare notes as only pals can. We talk about our kids' media consumption, the psychological benefits of taking the long view on things, and how critical it is to team up with your partner first. And remember, your kids are part of your life, not the center of it. Oh, and we also talk about the value of having a little indulgence every once in a while. Charlie is dad to his 4-year-old son and his 1-year-old daughter.
You're never going to be prepared. So just understand you can't be fully prepared and then you'll be fine. Like you can read the entire internet and it's not like other things in that you have to go through it, figure it out.
Yeah. I think that's it. That like experiential learning is so different than any advice that someone could give you or any book you could read or any, you know, video you could watch or even spending time with like other people's kids, you know, like, oh, I'm going to babysit my nephews or I'm going to hang out with my friend's son this weekend or something, whatever that little bit of exposure is that you think gives you some taste of it. It's never the same as that experiential learning of you being in the thick of it and having your own children.
I think about that a lot lately. I mean, if I'm with you or just like with any, like say you're out in public and you see someone and they seem to like quickly escalate how they're getting onto their child or something like that. You think, ah, let's like calm down. But then knowing myself and having a 3-teenager, I know that like, it's not that one instance. That's probably the 400th time that they've asked them not to do that one specific thing. And then nothing is getting through no matter how many approaches. So they're just, it's just exasperation that you're seeing, even though it seems to come out of nowhere. There's a long, long history that only that parent and that child kind of are involved in.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a lot more empathy for meltdowns and I don't think that I was ever judgy. Like if I saw some parent, like you said, exasperated, worn out, dealing with their kid or their kid, you know, throwing a fit in the middle of Target, I don't know. I just sort of acknowledged it and moved on. I was never like, oh my God, look at that parent. They're so shitty. But now I feel so different. I feel like multiple times I've made like eye contact with a mom or dad and just give them a nod like this, like, I see you, you know, like respect. Or even feel like if Javier is acting well and in contrast, there's, you know, a kid throwing a tantrum, I almost feel compelled every time not to apologize for Javier's good behavior, but to say, oh, you should have seen him just earlier today. Like my son looks right. Perfect against yours right now, but let me tell you, he was a complete mess just 3 hours ago, just so they feel like a little bit better.
Right, give it 5 minutes or one expectation not met. we'll go Hyde real quick. Oh wait, Jekyll, did I have it backwards? Dr. Hyde, Jekyll?
Dr. Jekyll. Yeah, you go Hyde.
Okay.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, man. So I'm hoping to just interview people that I have a lot of respect for creatively. Like I think what they make, whether that's music or books or films or design or, you know, any of their creative outputs, I have a lot of respect for what they make. And then I also have respect for how they conduct themselves as men/parents or fathers. One, because I want to expose other people to an alternative that I didn't really have in the beginning when we found out that we were pregnant. And then two, in addition to just exposure and saying, like, there are people out there who are doing great things. And if you're looking for someone to model yourself after or be inspired by or find motivation in, or just someone that you can make a positive comparison to, because I think there's so many things, thanks to social media or just thanks to how curated people are on the internet, where you could easily feel like less than and make comparisons and really beat yourself up. I want to do something against that. And for my own research, you know, like a chance to learn something from these guys, even if in the end, what I learn is nobody is good at it and everybody is struggling. And all the people that you think are kicking ass at it, they're just barely eking by. And there's something comforting in this shared struggle or frustration that should take the edge off of getting it perfect or being the best creative person with, you know, high output and also a really engaged dad who's present and sharing parenting responsibilities. So yeah, as I talk through that, what does it conjure in your mind? Like, I guess, where do you see yourself in this kind of battle, or do you see it as a battle anymore?
It's most certainly a battle. As I'm listening to you ask the question, it just reminds me of in fiction and character development, the best characters are flawed. They have good and bad. And I think that I am a flawed father. I'm a passionate, involved father that is also flawed. And I work from there. And I think, yeah, the challenge is to continuously be aware of that.
Yeah. I'd agree with both sentiments that, like, the most interesting characters are complex and they're not just purely, you know, one thing. And when you have flaws or you have kind of conflicts within character, they're just more interesting and I think more relatable. And so for you to describe yourself as, you know, a flawed father, or like that's your starting point, is just acknowledging that I'm engaged and I'm present and I'm really into being a dad. And at the same time, I'm flawed. I'm just curious, what defines flawed for you? Or like, how do you mean? Because I think I only ever see you in the context of, you know, both of our kids together. And I don't see things that stand out to me as like, oh man, that's a flaw. Like, you know, Charlie could be such a better dad than he is. I only see a peer on the same plane, just kind of trying to make it work.
By admitting that I'm a flawed father, I think I just, that's where growth happens. Like I make no assumptions that I've got this all figured out by now. I'm 3.5 years in. I don't know where the midpoint is, but it's not in sight. And I'm really involved. I try to keep my 3-year-old challenged because I try to like continuously figure out things. And then he's like a little emotional Rubik's Cube and I want to figure that out. And I never can line up all of the colors. And sometimes I make the wrong moves. And there's things that you want to correct about maybe the way that your own parents did things. And sometimes I'll catch myself like doing some of those things, like, I don't know, temper or just raising voice. These things happen and I pause like, we got to work on that. that's not helping anybody. Being conscious of that and always trying to improve versus just letting it go and being reactive.
Yeah. The fact that you are engaged and you care so much is why you're able to identify opportunities for improvement. You know what I mean? Like if you were kind of a hands-off dad or, you know, I'm here for wrestling and playing around and I'll change a diaper here and there, or, you know, yeah, I'll feed them, but I'm mostly here to just like clown around and be physical with my kids
take him to the park and teach him sports or, you know, read him a book. Like if you had like very specific, like I do these sets of things and then all the rest is like, I don't know, somebody else's job or I draw the line here. I think that anyone would get to a point where they're like, and I'm good with this set of things because I know them and I do them well with my kid. And then sort of beyond this comfort zone, that's where my partner or my wife steps in or something. Like I've talked to plenty of guys where their contributions are pretty well defined and they feel really good about them because they're familiar to them or they're what their dads did. And so they know them. But what you're describing is unfamiliar territory and really wanting to go deeper or to be different than your own dad was, you know, and this beautiful imagery of an emotional Rubik's cube and really trying to get all the sides lined up and the colors lined up is so spot on. Like that's exactly it. And like, as soon as you get all the yellows lined up, you turn it over and you realize the other side is all messed up, you know? And I've never solved a Rubik's cube without peeling all the stickers off and realigning them. So I've always cheated there. And for the idea that like, that's a human being is like, it's such a good visual metaphor.
Yeah, I've never solved one either.
And you had mentioned temper and raising your voice. And that, I think that's certainly one of the things that I, like out of all the attributes of, you know, quote unquote, a flawed dad or a dad who could do better, that's the one that I feel you 100%. I feel like if I looked at my long list of things that I know I'm not great at, yeah, I mean, there's just been some times where like, there's a certain dad growl that is just, it's like evolutionary or something. Like I didn't know I had it until I had a kid, until he pushed me to a threshold and I wasn't mature enough and didn't have my act together to say, I'm not going to allow a 3-year-old or a 4-year-old to push my buttons. Like I'm the adult. I've tipped over on that side of, you know, reacting to him and just screaming or doing something with a lot of force, whether that's like taking something out of his hands or just whatever it is. And as soon as I do it, I just feel like the worst human because I see in his face fear. You know, I'm a giant to him. And in that moment, I'm so overboard for what the situation calls for. And I just have such regret. Like as soon as I do it, I'm like, wow, I've crossed a line or I've done something and it's like, it scared you, you know, or whatever. And I just feel awful about it. You know, I'm usually like moved to tears. Like I'm kind of getting, you know, emotional talking about it now, but I'll just be like, Poppy is so, I'm so sorry, you know, and I've got to like beg for forgiveness after everything calms down. And of course he's like a kid and he's remarkable and elastic. And after we both kind of compose ourselves, he's always just forgiving or accepting. And he's like, it's okay. Or like, he'll apologize too, or whatever it is. And I'm like, man, if we're getting that intense and you're 4, I can't imagine when you're a teenager and we're both just at each other, you know?
Right. Yeah, it's primal. You just revert into this Neanderthal for about 15 seconds or something. And then you shake your head and come out of it. You're like, ah, not again. I know exactly what you mean. You get to points where you're like, I don't want to show him some teeth. I don't want him to fear me. But I need leverage from somewhere that's not just like denying something he wants to do. Like, you know what I mean? There's got to be something. I'm not trying to just assert authority. It's never a because I said so. It's always in his best interest. And you're trying to talk it out. And you're like, he doesn't care. He doesn't. He's mad right now because he's spilled over emotionally. But yeah, like there was one day where like, I don't know, say it's time for bed and no one has more shit on their to-do list than a toddler who's just been told it's time to go to bed.
That's so true.
And it ends up in just this impasse of like, I'm laying on the floor and I'm not moving. You know, it's protest. So you physically have to pick the child up and take him upstairs and you try to do it. It's a physical thing. What you try to do is with the least amount of violence as possible. Like you're not throwing the kid up. You're just picking him up or something. And it's just this crazy emotional and physical episode that you're trying to keep as calm as possible. And then my wife one time was like, well, you're taking him against his will. I'm like, he's not arguing in good faith. He's not using logic. He's not making a decision other than I don't want to do what I've been told. Yeah, I don't know. It's always a struggle.
It's really hard. I think we both have what I've learned to describe as spirited kids. And there's a great book, and it is about raising spirited children. And I would say that Amaya and for you, Lulu, they're very different. And it's not like, oh, it's a boys versus girls thing, because I've met little boys who act just like Amaya and Lulu. Sometimes you end up with a chill baby, you know, and sometimes you end up with a spirited kid, and they're both awesome and they require different techniques. And I think the sooner you recognize which one you have, the better, you know, so that you can adapt and not lose your mind. And I'm so grateful that my first kid was spirited and my second kid was chill, because the other way around, oh man, you know, like your first kid is hard because it's your first kid. And if you get tricked and you end up with a chill kid and you're like, oh man, this kid's really hard, but you have no frame of reference, and all the while you have a chill kid, and then you have another one and that kid's spirited, holy shit, you're doomed, because you totally you have no idea, you know? And like, I guess you've got the benefit of like, it's your second kid, so you're a little bit more prepared, but man, you are in for a world of hurt, because it's a totally different thing. On more than one occasion, you've mentioned like, I don't know if I'm great for the show. I've put a lot of these things on pause, or I'm still struggling with where those sorts of things slot into my life, where I'm working full time and now I'm teaching and I have two kids. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah. So my daughter just turned one this past weekend, and that feels like a milestone. Like I definitely put a lot of things on hiatus. Like my son came along, all right, you kind of just clear the desk and kind of put a baby on it and make it a changing table. and you focus on that. And just when we're getting the hang of that, we had our second child. And now that I'm just outside of the first year, I feel like I'll get less and less comfortable with not pushing on the other things outside of just work and home life. I am pretty happy with my normal job. I'm pretty challenged and fulfilled and have a lot of freedom. And it's also a company that really has great respect for work-life balance. I don't feel the need to find some creative outlet because I'm not being challenged at work. That being said, there's always things that you want to do that you don't get to do at work. So that's why I feel like I have an intentional weakness for the creative endeavors of friends projects that I end up on. You know, if you're handy with a computer, you become your family's IT guy. And I'm kind of like that with Squarespace sites. I keep building like websites for my family members. I mean, it's, I don't know, there's money here and there, but it's more about like, oh, you need a website? Yeah, let's make it. And you just kind of put something together over a weekend, send me some pictures. So my side hustle is being the family website.
Yeah, you're a webmaster.
Right.
Squarespace webmaster. You got to update your LinkedIn too to reflect that title. Yeah, you know, something that you said, I feel similarly, like until the sabbatical, until the decision to launch the show, I too found it easier to work on other people's things and call that my side hustle or let that pacify me a bit. It's not that helping a family member set up a Squarespace, it's not nothing. Like that takes time. It takes some problem solving, some creativity. Like it's not a rote task. Like it's still, yes, it's templated, but it's still involved. And those hours, I'm sure, could be spent on your own thing, or it could be spent on something that wasn't for someone else. And so I have some thoughts on why I did it up till now, but I'm curious, like, how come that feels easier or doable to you, and that you wouldn't put those same hours towards something else for yourself?
Right. I don't know. It's a personality quirk. I guess I'll use the analog from education that I prefer to be more of a guide on the side than the sage on the stage. I don't have a strong desire to like create a side company and start something and launch it and be the CEO and founder of something. But I do love developing talent and cool stuff with other people. I did one of these, the Gallup Strengths Finder not too long ago. It's almost like a personality test, but the main thing I got back was that I'm more of a developer. So I see the potential in others, and that's what I get a great satisfaction and working with and helping. I do similar things at work, kind of backed away from project leadership and rather support more teams than to lead a single one. So I think that's just how my personality works. I'm not too good with recognition for whatever silly reason.
I've known that about you from art school days, and maybe why I enjoy collaborating with you so much is your flexibility, your willingness to see things from lots of angles and not be ego-driven about it, but also really, really good at what you do and where that expertise just like levels other people up or elevates their work. Like I think of so many creative visions or ideas that I've come to you with that are like, they're just mail formed. Like they're not ready for prime time. And I'll bring you like a kernel of an idea, or like, even when we were talking about music, it might be like a little sample or a lyric. And you can take that and do so much goodness with it and hand it back and be like, you mean like this? And I'm like, oh, that's like a million times better than what I had in mind. And thanks for, you know, making it great, you know? And so with that personality, how does that impact your approach to being a dad?
I feel a lot of tensions in those moments that I was describing earlier. Like I never want it to be because I said so, because this is what I want. Everything feels like it needs to be framed around what's in their best interests. And I guess it just comes back to ego. Like I want to support Houston and all his creative things, but without making it, you know, like you should like golden era hip hop because I like golden era hip hop.
Yeah.
I haven't gotten around to making a playlist that's fully censored. So I haven't like, you know.
But I think there's something there is a tension in that. And I want Javier to find his own things. I can want that for him, and he'll do it on his own, right? He'll find music, or the same way we did it, right? Someone at school will have, you know, a song on their phone or describe something to him. Before, it would have been like someone brought the tape to school, right? Or whatever. And he'll discover his own thing. And I think he has, at least musically, you know, he's kind of got his own thing. And I don't want to force him to like a type of music. And at the same time, it's sort of our job, having seen more of the world, to expose him to it, or at least make opportunities for him to kind of stumble into it. And we can be accidental about it, like just be listening to music in the car and have him go, oh, you know, Dad, what's that? And okay, here's a learning moment. Let me tell you about this. Or intentional, like, son, I want to sit you down. I'm going to play you my favorite song, or whatever that is. And I think I find myself doing a little bit of both. And that's kind of the trick, is to expose him to new things without being prescriptive or without issuing some sort of mandate. And there's a few things that I just draw the line that I'm like, no, my son's not going to listen to that. You know, like I forgot who it was that he came home talking about, because an older kid liked this artist. Oh, it was Justin Bieber. He came home and he said, he's talking about Justin Bieber. And I'm like, there's no way you know anything about Justin Bieber except from this other kid. And he said, Justin Bieber is a rock star. And I said, oh, no. Justin Bieber is a pop star. And there's a big difference between a pop star and a rock star. And I said, a rock star. And I, you know, I had to break it down for him, you know. And again, like, he can listen to whoever he wants, but like, it has to be true. And I think you and I care so much about music and art. And I'm assuming most of the guests on this show are passionate about this because they're creative. You know, I have said, and I'm curious what you think, because you grew up with sports. Like, you're way more like sports. I don't even know the right way to describe this because I'm so not sports, but like, you're way more athletic or sports minded than I was. Like, you played a lot of sports as a kid. And I think I played every sport for like a season just to strike it from the list. Like, yep, nope, I hate that too. Except for basketball. I played basketball, but it was only because I was tall for my age. I was not good. I was like a horrible ball handler. And like, I remember shooting on my own basket once in a game, and just awful, you know? And so like, what if Houston ends up like just not interested in art or design or craft or creativity or the things that, you know, we measure our life and success by? What if he just can't be bothered and he's not into it? And not that these things are opposites, but like, what if he's way more passionate about science or math or engineering or even sports? You know, what are you going to do?
I think that that's one of the things that I really appreciate about, I mean, there's many things. I had a great childhood. I don't want to allude to my parents being bad or anything like that. But that one of the things that I appreciate the most about the way that I came up was that they didn't push things on me. They kind of let me find my own way. I don't even remember why I played Little League. I mean, I'm sure they signed me up, but I never felt pushed to do any of those things. I feel like I would try my best to accept whatever it is that he wants to do, even if it's completely not creative. Math and science is awesome. I thought I was going to be an accountant until, you know, the final semester of high school. I think I would go along with whatever he wanted to do. I played mostly baseball, some soccer, but in high school I played baseball. I tried to get on the high school team. I was always just kind of mediocre. I was a third baseman. The highlight of my baseball career was a walk-off grand slam that I hit in Little League. And it was an in the park home run, because that's how Little League works. But yeah, I won a game with a grand slam once, and now I think I was 8 years old, and it just went downhill from there. But in high school, what's important about this story is I didn't make the team, but I stuck around. I was my own little Rudy story. It's kind of sad, but to me that it says something different. Like I couldn't hit that great. It was terrible, but just not as good as the guys that made the team. And I could throw really good. I was a pitcher, but I couldn't field the ball. So I spent like half the season not being on the team, but still forcing myself to hang out with the team and like help them and go with the team on trips as kind of a standby. I didn't have a jersey. I don't know why I did that. Like it was pretty brutal. I wasn't particularly even really good friends with any of the people on the team. I just was like fucking determined to get on this team, even though I couldn't do it, or even though there wasn't space. You know, mid-season, one of the guys was just like, "Ah, this is stupid. I quit," and he just quit the team. And like during a game, I think he got mad at the coach or something like that. And on the bus on the way back, the coach brought the jersey back to me. I was sitting at the middle of the bus just by myself, whatever. So he brings the jersey. He's like, "Well, you know, this is yours now." And I was like, "Oh, cool." And just kind of looking at it myself, and just like in a movie or something, there's like this slow clap starts from the back of the bus. Like I said, it was my Rudy moment. I didn't think anyone was paying attention, but everyone was like, cool. They clapped. They cheered me. Didn't get a lot of playing time, but I was like, all right, I did it. I tried really hard and I made it on the team. And that's what I was trying to do. And fatherhood kind of feels like that. I don't feel like I'm doing everything right or an all-star or anything like that, but I'm damn determined to not give up on it and to keep pushing even when things feel like there's not even space for me to be on the team.
Yeah, I love that story. And I feel like even in telling it, you downplay it, you know, of course, because that's that's how you grow. But man, at the right time when you share that story with Houston and Lulu, that's life-changing story to me. Like to hear that at the right moment when one of them doesn't make a team or one of them isn't accepted into a thing. And you talk about that determination and focus. And like you said, like it's brutal. You're tagging along. You're spending all the time that you could have being a kid doing something else, you're traveling with them to games, you know, on the bus. Like, that's amazing. I mean, that's an outstanding story. Also, like, great material for a short. You are a video artist, a filmmaker, a documentarian, a motion designer, cameraman, sound guy, editor. I mean, I know you have, you know, parts of that list that you'd like doing more than others, but I've always thought of you in the full spectrum of narrative, digital story making in like the broadest sense, and that you have, you know, skills and ability across all of those things. And you could be a one-man show. And so with that range of abilities and experiences, because you've done all of these things in different capacities for lots of people, what is normally proud parent home video is always awesome coming from you. Like, we went sledding together and you shot footage off of, you know, your Google phone, whatever it was. And I was like, oh yeah, send me that. And normally a dad would send you some weird compressed shitty version via text message.
Like SMS.
And instead, like by the end of the night, you had this cut. Like, it actually had like a little bit of motion design or like on-screen graphics and captioning for our own marble mouth children. And it was just great. It was like epic slow-mo action footage of, you know, their first trip sledding. And so there's just that all by itself. Like, when your dad is a motion designer and filmmaker, your home videos, whenever it is that you get around to finally editing them, they're all going to be amazing little short films. A question specific to that is, with all of that talent and ability, what do you think you'll do as Lulu gets a little bit older, as Houston is a little more independent, like as you start to gain that freedom back? Like, what do you aspire to do? Like, what's some of the things that, even if you're beating yourself up about not doing them now, like, what's still on your creative bucket list?
I have like an ever-extending trail of unedited home video stuff just filling up a drive downstairs. And in my mind, those are going to like turn into supercuts on birthdays and stuff. And that's been slow to happen so far. So yeah, I always want to make cooler things. And the reason I made the sled thing so fast, because I knew if I didn't do it within 24 hours and it's that window closes, you know, it just slips away from you. I don't have a grand vision. I would like to make a feature length documentary someday. I don't have a grand vision of what that would be yet. And it's started. I think the steps towards that are these kind of little vignettes that I want to do. I have a colleague, John, that I work pretty closely with, and he's just an amazing researcher and interviewer. And we always talk about like, oh, all the stuff we did at work together, we don't want to do that. Just go out and find stories. It's like, you know, interview a few people in your family and make a little something out of it, or tell the story of a small business of some friends I know that own a toy store on Western. I just think there's lots of little vignettes that can be told and made really interesting as more practice rounds building up to some kind of feature length documentary when it occurs to me or you or us together.
Yeah.
Yeah. The video, I don't know, with the home videos, it's, I don't know, I'm very conscious of, you think of your audience first, right? Video storytelling or whatever is, it's essentially just intent and audience. And I always think of who's going to watch this in 20 years, or if no, maybe no one ever does, but if someone watches this in 20 years, they're going to hear me under my breath or behind the camera saying something about what's going on. And like, that's what's super valuable. Even if it's completely raw and unedited, someone's going to have a really awesome time with that in the far, far future.
Yeah, I like the idea of making even, you know, short video clips of your kid eating solid food for the first time, or whatever little marker or milestone you capture, that all of those, no matter how small, are moments toward something as significant a creative achievement as a feature length anything, you know, documentary or a fictional narrative or whatever, and that has a lot of value all by itself. Like, that's an insight to me, because I feel like those could be just like throwaway moments, or those could just be like quick captures and I'll pull them up on my phone and show somebody at work, but to somewhere in the back of your mind, know that even if this mundane life moment is fleeting, me recording it and me being thoughtful about its meaning 20 years out, like you said, that brings it up a little bit and it makes it part of what will eventually be the foundation for which to do something really big, like a feature length documentary. And that could be anything, right? That could be a quick sketch. That could be a really quick little 5-song mix that you put together. That could be a paragraph of dialogue that you quickly hammer out that then becomes the basis, or at least like kind of keeps you warm, where that creativity doesn't ice over, I think is important. Yeah. But I'm glad to hear that. I don't know that I've ever heard you say that out loud, that's your intention, or like all of this is sort of leading to that. Is really nice to hear for the first time.
I have a box of VHS tapes in the basement from home movies that I haven't looked at in a long time, and I need to digitize before the tapes just kind of disintegrate. But I don't have that documentation leading up to this moment. Like, Houston and Lulu are going to have so much more. And it's not like, that's not unique to my kids. Everyone, I mean, other people might share it out socially and the videos may end up in different places, but there's so much more, so many more artifacts of growing up that you can go back to and reflect on. And I'm just curious about what that is going to mean. Is that just, no, that's just a way of life, and Houston and Lulu will never go back and look at any of that stuff. And then they'll probably be embarrassed about it. And like, why did you put my pictures on Facebook? That, like, I don't know where that's going to go, but it's interesting.
Yeah, it is a unique time. Like, we all have really, really high quality documentary tools in our pockets. And it's like the democratization of any medium that before had such a high barrier to entry. And now, like, anyone can make anything. And that's why we've got, you know, so many garbage SoundCloud rappers and just awful video on YouTube. And so you could say on one hand, well, doesn't that just add like so much more garbage to wade through, because now everybody can make it, and before only people who had means could make it. But just because you have money and can buy a nice camera doesn't mean you have good taste. Like, you might still make total garbage. And so I hope that in all of it, like, the production of more stuff means more media ownership and more ownership of our stories, which I think is like the real social benefit, is like people have more control over their own narratives, their own stories, their own records, their own history in ways that many people and communities never could. And I think that's a really powerful and important thing, because whoever writes the history wins, you know, and just being able to write your own, I think, is a source of power. And then when it comes to like our kids, like they'll be just as embarrassed. You know, I found old footage recently cleaning out the studio and going through like all my college work, you know, video art, and it's so bad. It's awful. It's like I was just grimacing and like wincing the whole time, and I couldn't even get through some of it. I'm like, this is just so bad. I have to destroy this tape before any other human sees it, because I'll lose all credibility as a creative person if this gets in the wrong hands.
Throwing it away is not enough.
Yeah, no, I had to like have a little funeral pyre and like set it on fire. Yeah, it's just bad news.
I think what's funny about that, like, I remember, and I still have it. I have my dad's old sketching portfolio. And I remember finding that as a kid in the attic. I was like, oh, this is really cool. There's this one sketch of this guy. He kind of looked like a cross between a Steven Tyler and a pirate. Or, I mean, I guess Steven Tyler kind of looks like a pirate. But, you know, it was just this really interesting character. His black hair and big mustache. And I just thought, like, this is the coolest sketch. This is so interesting. I thought that was cool for, you know, years. And he told me much later on that it was on an album cover or something, and he was just looked at it and tried to like reproduce it. Whatever. I'm still glad that I thought it was cool for so long. But I could see, you know, if he never gets a hold of some of my weird experimental television center stuff from that residency I did in upstate New York, he might think it was pretty interesting, even though to me it's just kind of analog video noise.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's a good point. We all have our own visual sensibilities, and we come to it with that. And yeah, some people see things that others don't. How do your kids play a role in creative endeavors? Like, I know they're often the subject of videos and things like that, but when you think about making a documentary, would any of it be influenced by your role as a dad or by your kids, or are there other things that you would make that you might not have if you weren't a dad or you didn't have a house full of kids' toys? Or
I kind of always had the notion that I wanted to have children and a relationship with them and help them. I don't know, I just always was looking forward to having kids. And now that they are here, I still want to do things creatively, but like, as important to me is developing them. Like, to me, that is the most creative thing I do is working with them, or like keeping him challenged, whether it's encouraging him to do the magnetiles in a way that uses more triangles instead of all square. You know what I mean? Like, I'm constantly using up a lot of creative energy. I mean, I'm not using it up, but I'm kind of transferring it to them, and that feels worthwhile and rewarding to me. I guess I'll give an example. Like, Houston's interested in, and he's getting more and more interested in music and kind of singing. And he's got, you know, we have a dance party after dinner every night. I mean, right now it's the same three songs, but we're working on switching it up. But he'll say, all right, everybody calm down. All right, everybody stop. I've got a song. I want to write a song. Here it goes. And then if you start to sing it with him, he's like, no, just listen to me first. And he'll kind of like lead this song. And a lot of times it's like completely nonsensical, not words. It's just va 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 vu vu va vi va da, you know, just kind of spitting out syllables. And it's really important to me for whatever reason to kind of like, oh, cool. And I'll remember, I'll recite it right back to him. And I'll try to get as close as I can to sing what he actually said, even though it's nonsensical. Just as a way to encourage, like, oh yeah, do that. Keep pushing on it. It doesn't have to be words. You're just working with melody now. We'll keep doing that. And I can see him like respond. I don't know. I feel like I'm noticing him continue to push that. And I hope that it's because I encourage it and I let him know that I'm listening and it's important to me by spitting it right back to him. I don't know if I'm getting too off the path, but like that feels very creative to me in a way that is as satisfying, I think, as at least at the moment with them being so young, as making my own thing.
Yeah, I dig it. I think that's really important, that what could just be written off as goofing around, or like you said, as nonsensical gibberish or whatever, that you treat it differently and again, kind of elevate it to something more and put some energy behind it. That reinforcement, it goes right back to what you said, you know, like I am the developer, like I see good in the things that people make and I turn the volume up on those things, right? Like I take this kernel of an idea and I process it into something really refined and great, or I amplify this thing by just giving it space or acknowledging it, or, you know, saying, yeah, 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 more of that, you know, and just channeling energy that way into something. It's just awesome. That's what I think great mentors and teachers and guides do, you know, and to be able to do that for your kid and see even in small ways, like a little bit of progress or a little bit of them going like, oh yeah, yeah, I'm going to tap back into that thing that we did last night. I'm going to pick up where I left off. Or I'm going to do that thing, but I'm going to do it more. I'm going to add a layer to it. It's just exceptional, you know, to be able to bear witness to, I think is so powerful. This idea of your creative energy or your creative output right now as fuel on your kids' creative fire, it's a really beautiful thing and a selfless thing in ways. And I think, again, something that when you feel like I've got so many things I want to do creatively and it's very self-motivated or self-focused, to be able to get joy or fulfillment out of doing that through somebody else, I think is a very good alternative to what I've struggled with, which has just been ugly resentment, you know, and frustration and almost like a creative anger, you know, where it's just like, I have this unrest in me and this list of things and everything else stands in its way, you know. How do you reframe that? How do you change that? How do you, you know, take some of the, like what's the pressure release valve for those feelings?
Yeah, I don't know. My hesitation here is I don't want to act like, oh yeah, just being a parent is beautiful and it's okay to write off everything else as long as your kid's doing okay. That's, I don't know. It's not really what I'm trying to say, but it's not necessarily a zero sum. I don't want to pretend like there's no nagging ambition. Like, oh, you were supposed to get to this little side thing this weekend and you ended up just kind of exhausted and telling yourself that you would do it after they went to bed and after dinner. And then you watched an episode of a show and then went to bed because you two were out of gas. I'm aware of those feelings. I don't know. The reframe is thinking of it as I'm channeling that energy into this right now. I'm going to get back to these other things. I'm not going to wait until college, but they're like particularly young. And so that just needs more right now. When Lulu was born, I got to take a 6.5 months to stay home. After a couple months, when I settled into the newborn thing again, I just got into sneakers as like a fun side thing. Just like this is something that's fun. That's just for me. Like this is just interesting and fun for me. And I intentionally said, I'm going to get involved with this. And I, I, I deserve that. and I know that it's important to do that. I think the tendency probably with most parents is just to give everything away. Your entire self is just forfeited for the foreseeable future. But if you're intentional about taking some of it back, I think that's okay. To me, it feels like it's okay when you get back some of those moments from the kid. Like when you see something that you've been working on in your head and you see that it has had an effect.
I think the idea of having these pressure release valves, having these things that you're aware of and can acknowledge, yeah, right now this is it. This is it, and that's okay. And it's time bound. And I know that it's not forever. Or in lieu of this, I'm going to do these things. And do they totally fulfill me creatively? No, not yet. But they're steps towards something, or they're reminders that I have this ability, or they're little sketches for something to come later. Or even, like you said, like getting into kind of sneaker collecting and that sort of thing, like that's cultural. That's art. That's creativity. That's fashion design. That's, that's streetwear. That has a lot of aspects of this kind of world that we exist in as designers and artists and creative people. And so it's not a stretch for me to see a kind of indulgent pastime or hobby, kind of having fun and doing that. That to me that's totally appropriate. It's not like you started, like you picked up gambling as a hobby. You know what I mean? Right. Like, you picked up something that's interesting and that you're inspired by. And I mean, the number of books that I have in my collection of inspiration that are around sneaker culture, like I probably have 5 books just about that. And like, I don't design sneakers and it's not something I want to do for a living, but I have them as influences and as inspiration. And sometimes those voids can be filled with hobbies, the way that you're describing, or with collections, or just the sort of conscious gathering of raw material for application or use later.
Right.
I think is something interesting you do.
You said indulge, and that's interesting. Like because that feels, if I'm thinking of like the things that were put on the chopping block when you enter parenthood, like you have to go to work, you have to keep the baby breathing and stuff. Like you have to do all the normal things and keep yourself alive and healthy, hopefully. But indulging is right out of the gates goes, or at least it feels like that's the most acceptable thing to let go of. And from your past life, the things that you just kind of are interested in are fun, but I think it's important to get a few of those back. It's okay to indulge and to do something just for you.
Yeah. I think it's really healthy. Mark Goodchild, right? DJ Exit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I can't think of a more accomplished audio engineer. He's somebody that I've always held up in such high regard. You close your eyes and you think of any famous musician and artist, and I guarantee he's worked with them at length, And so here's a guy who is just surrounded by some of the most talented, creative, musical genius, in the world. And that's not an exaggeration. Like that's what the dude does every day is that work. And I think I had texted him when Javier was born, and he gave me the best advice and has no children. He wasn't married at the time. He has no children. He calls all of these musicians clients, right? And so he's like, I'm surrounded by clients all day. And the one thing that I've seen consistently and that I've been told consistently, this is Mark talking, is your kids have to fit into your life, not the other way around. Mm-hmm. And he's like, that's what I've seen my clients live every day when they bring their kids to the studio with them, or when they go on tour and their kids tag along, or when they go to a photo shoot and their kids are present. And they do that because they're exposing their kids to a whole world that most kids will never see. They're staying connected to their kid, even in the thick of travel and practice and performance and tours. And they didn't like cancel their tour because they had a kid. They folded the kid into it and brought them along. in the moment, I didn't get it. And I was like, cool, bro. Thanks for the feedback. You know, like, how about congratulations? Or like, wow, that's amazing. Instead, it was just like, don't let the kid change your life.
Right.
Bend the kid's will to your existence. Now I can say that's some of the best advice I ever had, is like, even in the most simple things, like bringing your kid along while you run errands, while it sounds like, oh God, I got to bring my kid along while I run errands. You don't not do the errands, right? You don't let laundry just pile up because your kid wants to play, or you don't not go buy groceries because your kid would rather go to the park. Like, your kid comes along and you turn it into an adventure and you just fold them into it. And I wonder if there are creative practices where we can better integrate our kids into it, where it just becomes regular and it doesn't feel like we have to blow up our processes in order to incorporate our children or have them be present or have them bear witness to the making, or, you know, and I'm sure there's tons of stuff where you're like, yeah, no, actually this is off limits. Like, the kid is not going to be part of this because it's distracting, or it adds, you know, more stress than needs to be, or I'm working with, you know, adult themes in this narrative and I don't want my kid to see this, or whatever it is. But I just love the idea that maybe there is a way somehow to fold the kids into what it is we're trying to do, rather than putting all of those things on pause and saying, yeah, I'll get to it someday.
Yeah, I definitely hear that. I think that's when it gets really fun. I get a kick out of it when Houston comes over, and maybe I have him Photoshop or something. To him, Photoshop means you're changing colors of things, not necessarily editing or any of that stuff. Get a real kick out of that. Before Houston was born, I think we saw this special called Bringing Up Baby, I think is what it was called. It was like a 4-part UK thing. And I think they mentioned some of the stuff you're describing is like, I don't know, like the French child rearing method or whatever, like just culturally, it's more emphasis on the child as part of your life and part of your life, not the center, which I think makes sense. And I think that's
That's a hugely important distinction.
Right. And it's what when we get in the car or when we're at home playing hangout music, I never just put it on the kids' music station and let that run. It's always, I always make sure it's appropriate, but it's always my music. You know what I mean? And it's not whatever it is, jazz or hip hop or something that's not necessarily just kids' music. And to me, that's a conscious decision of like, taking him along with me. This is something that we both want to listen to. So, or that, you know, I want to hear, I think you'll like it. If not, we'll change it. We'll find something else, but it's not just going to be Sesame Street or whatever it is that he's into. And I think that gets easier and easier as he gets older and we can do more of those things together.
I applaud that. There's a handful of children's artists, children's groups that I found that I'm like, hell yeah, has really good lyrics and like great musicianship. And I'm not embarrassed to play this music. This music doesn't feel dumbed down to me in some way, or like I can play this in the car and not drive on oncoming traffic. But for the most part, it's pretty bad. You know, it's pretty unlistenable. I have to be really mindful because so much hip hop that I love and that I came up listening to, like when I go back to it now, I'm like, God damn, this is the most homophobic, misogynistic stuff I'm listening to it differently. Like when you're stupid and you're in junior high or high school, you're just like, you're into the beat or, you know, some other part of it. And to go back to some of it now, I'm just like, yikes. Like I don't even want to listen to this myself anymore. But for the most part, it's awesome. You know, when I think of like Native Tongues and, you know, the sort of boom bap era hip hop, he's not ready for it yet. And sometimes I'll find a song that's okay. And he calls it beat music.
Yeah.
And he never calls it hip hop or rap. He's like, I want to listen to some of that beat music. And that to me says everything. Like he's paying attention to the beat or the rhythm to it. And it's very different than the music that his mother plays, which is a lot of folk music. Like he loves Prince and he loves Smells Like Teen Spirit by Nirvana. Thankfully, Kurt Cobain's lyrics are so unintelligible. Like right. He's not really picking up everything that's there.
It's another instrument.
You know, I love that he loves that music and that he recognizes those artists when he hears them. And like, I'm proud of that because it means that he's being folded into our life and what we like, instead of us saying like, yeah, I guess I'll listen to this this awful nursery rhyme for the 100th time in a row.
I do have an appreciation. There's definitely some good children's programming on Spotify. Like I don't mean to act like all that stuff is terrible. It's just, that's one of those points in my life that I'm aware of where I'm like, no, I want to do it my way and come with me versus just everything being about him and what he wants.
Yeah. I feel the same about feature length movies. Javier has a real issue with intense animation. A colleague of mine says, oh, he's really into guitar. Like, he'd love Coco. It's amazing. It's all about music and you know, Latin culture. And, you know, how have you not seen that? And, and I watched it all the way through. And there is plenty of shit in there that I was like, yeah, no way is a four-year-old going to even understand what happened. And that's really intense. And it has to do with, like, murder and sabotage.
Yeah, anything.
We're certainly going to have to fast forward through whole chunks or just like skip to the big music bits. And so I watched it and kind of had that in mind. And he had read a Coco book that he really loved. He likes the guitars and the mariachis, the whole thing. He's into it, you know? And so then I'm like, okay, perfect. Let's watch the movie. And you know, the opening of like every Disney movie where like an arc of fireworks kind of
the pixie
flies over the, you know, the Disney castle. Mm-hmm. And we got about 4 seconds into that and he starts hysterically crying. Like he wouldn't even let Coco start. There was just some level of intensity or anticipation to this to this opening scene. And I was like, Javier. He's like, I don't want to watch it. I'm like, Javier, you know, and I pause it and I'm like, son, you don't have to watch anything. I'm never going to force you to watch something, especially if it's scary to you. But help me understand what you just saw that made you so scared. And he can't handle it. And 6 months passes. I'm like, you want to give Coco another shot? You love the story. You want to try? And he's like, okay, you know, and I'm like, I don't want you to do this. If you don't want to do it, you know, you're not going to watch this until you're ready. And so he got a little bit past it to like the opening scene. I realized that, and this is so sweet, he's so passionate about music and he loves music so much. He loves music probably the way I loved, you know, art as a kid. And he's afraid of the grandmother in Coco because he can't understand how someone could hate music as much as her character does. And there's nothing like more evil or mean as someone who would stand in the way of music. Mm-hmm. And like, I totally didn't understand that. He's so afraid of the grandmother character because, you know, most of the movie, she doesn't want Miguel to play music and she wants him to work in the shop. And so he's scared of the grandmother who hates music so much so that he loses it.
Yeah.
He won't even let her appear on the screen.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. And I told him, well, you know, in the storybook that you have that eventually the grandmother loves music, you know, and that Miguel is able to show his whole family the power of music. So you know that's coming. You know that's how it's going to end. And in the beginning, it doesn't feel that way. But like, you know the story. Like, you know, spoiler alert, grandma changes her mind. She loves music. And he just can't fathom a person who doesn't love music or who would stand in the way of it. And he's afraid of her because of it. She's like the wicked witch.
Look, Dad, underlying themes of death and loss, I got no problem with. But she doesn't like music. Like, no deal. Yeah. I have this very vivid memory of being home, and I think I was maybe sick or something. You know, you kind of like just let everything fall to the floor when you're sick. You're like, all right, we're gonna sit down and watch this movie together. And it was something live action. It wasn't like a Lethal Weapon 2 or anything. It was just, but I don't remember what the movie was, but I just remember thinking like, oh, this is okay. He's not gonna have a problem. He can just sit with me and kind of look at what's going on. And, you know, about 10 minutes in, it was comedy. So it was like slapstick. Someone knocked someone else on the ground or something. You know, there was some kind of physical thing that wasn't, to me, it was just like nothing. But I saw like he had this visceral, like he just jerked back. Like he was so surprised that someone just got like struck in the head with something. Even if, you know, it was funny, it did not make sense. It was just someone just got hit in the head and it hurt them. And the way that I saw the way he reacted, I was like, all right, okay. And I like turned it off right away, and I've not been the same about it since. Like, I've been way more sensitive. Maybe that was just the moment. I was like, hey, he's watching, he's paying attention, and it matters. Like, don't be lazy about what you're letting, you know, come across the screen while he's looking at it.
I feel like I can recall instances like that where you realize like, oh, yep, I just screwed up. Like, let's not tell mom about that or DCFS.
Or when that like Nemo is pretty quiet, cool little movie, and then that shark shows up and fills the screen with teeth, and you're like, come on.
I know.
It's just teeth and danger, and we were having such a good time, and now he's crying.
Yeah. I'm curious, if you don't have it now, what does balance look like when you're needing to feel like all is not lost and there's a long future of making things and side projects and maybe one day a feature-length documentary? Describe the ideal state for evenness in your making and your parenting.
In my head, when they hit, maybe it's that 5-year threshold that you mentioned earlier, when they get a little more self-sufficient, you know, they don't need someone involved in their playtime, then I'll get more and more of that time back to, you know, maybe it's a little side hustle project, or maybe if it's something else, going out to shoot an interview on a Saturday, it feels like that's going to get easier and easier. I don't know if that's just my relentless optimism, but that's what the back and forth that was so hectic in the beginning feels like. It gets slower and slower and more even with every day and month that they get closer towards doing things on their own and not needing my wife and I to be involved. Every time they get a little more sufficient, that's another tick back in our column of time that we get to do our own thing. So as far, I don't see it as like a point. I think it's more of a horizon line, you know? Yeah. I don't know.
That visual of the rocking back and forth, or that seesaw, or just taking turns really as a parent, and that intensity is hard and untenable. I feel like you can't do that forever. And thankfully, these two lines that were sort of crossing, you're ramping up and you're reclaiming yourself and time and some flexibility and some freedom and those things. As they're ramping down their desperate need, you know, and their demand on you for, quite literally in the beginning, survival. And then
right.
And then it shifts to help taking a bath and tying shoes. And then that shifts. And I don't think it ever goes away, because your kids are always in need of something. You know, I'm hopeful that we get better at it and they get better at it. And somewhere things kind of normalize. And it's there that we may be able to have, you know, like peak creativity again. And so I guess the question is, for someone who's like, yeah, I'm not waiting 5 years, fuck that. Or feels like, I don't want to do that. Like that. What about all the time between now and then, you know? And it sounds like it's dot, dot, dot. It doesn't sound like it's a full stop period, you know?
Well, that, yeah, that's what I was saying. It's not a line to cross. It's like a long stairway. Like, it's, you know what I mean? It gets a little bit, I don't feel like, oh, I'm going to get to this point where they're five and then we're golden and I can get back to my stuff. It's just, it's going to be a gradient.
What advice do you have for the creative guy who's about to become a dad, and who, if everyone's not telling them this, they may feel it just instinctually that creative life is over. I'm about to become a dad. What do you say to that person?
I think the best advice that I can remember reading or hearing or whatever before parenthood was, if you want to be a good father, be a good husband. And I'm definitely a flawed husband as well. And I'm definitely not the perfect husband, but it's one of the ways that I've reframed it and think about it and strive to be better at. But so one thing that kind of stuck versus all of it, the weird stuff, like always have to change the clothes, whatever. If you want to be a good father, be a good husband, and think of it through that lens. As far as the creative.
Wait, can we go back to that?
Yeah.
Why is that true? What have you experienced, or how does being a good husband, what are some of the things in that identity that make the father identity better, do you think?
I don't know. I don't want to claim to have all of the father, mother roles all figured out, but like in the beginning, that feels totally critical. All right, you're newborn, you need to take care of mom. There's a different relationship here. You're a support role for a minute. But then you just kind of continue with that. You get more and more, instead of two parents frantically trying to figure out how to keep a kid alive, healthy, challenged, encouraged, you're remembering that you're still married to your wife, and this is still a really, it's not just two people taking care of a thing, it's a family. And right out of the gate, being very conscious about remembering how important she is, and kind of just goes back to the kid being a part of your life versus the center of it. Like that kid's joining your family, and it's not just two people by the seat of their pants trying to hold on and figure it out as they go.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. You characterized it really well. It's not every man for himself, you know what I mean, or every person for themselves. It's this little being was introduced into something that already existed, a relationship between two partners or two parents. And it doesn't nullify that or somehow like subvert that. It shouldn't, you know, I think is what you're saying. It's like that should be reinforced, and you should double down on your husband identity in support of and in partnership with your partner or your wife, so that you come from a foundation of strength to do all the new dad things that you don't have experience in, and you can at least lean back on the sort of foundation or that base of being a husband and having that other person's back, shared parenting from that standpoint, rather than two separate individuals who are both just eking by, you know, or like,
right.
I think that's really a great point, because I found myself to be most out of control as a dad when I don't feel like I have Maris's support, or where she and I are not aligned, or where we haven't called a timeout and huddled up as mom and dad to get in sync, and then go back to Javier with, you know, okay, so here's the plan, or like, okay, Javier, this is what your mom and dad have decided. When I feel like I'm alone, or when I feel like I'm making it up as I go, or I just haven't connected with Maris in any kind of meaningful way as just husband and wife, I feel like that's when I am the worst. Like I'm the least prepared. I'm flying off the handle. I'm just not good. I'm not a good dad. And when she and I can get in sync, or where I feel like, hey, you know, even if my kid's crazy right now, at least we're normal. Strong, then I can at least approach it from a different perspective or something.
Right. I think it's really easy to forget about yourself. And I think it's also, if I hadn't heard that, I don't think I would have paid enough attention and just continuously reminded myself of how important our relationship was before and continues to be, even though there's the children. It's easy to just kind of pour everything, like your ambition, your time, everything into the kid, because that feels like what is required to be a good parent. It feels that way, but I don't think that that's true. I think that there definitely is a lot. There's a lot that you give up, and a lot that you, like I said, I call it channeling versus sacrificing. But it's very, very important to remember that relationship.
Yeah. Looking back, like you said, you're 3 years into this identity and this role. What advice would you give to yourself as a new dad, but also one who's thinking about what being a new dad means for their career or creative pursuits?
I don't feel so fresh still. Like I was just going through it yesterday. I know there's...
Yeah, no. If you don't have anything, still too fresh that I get it. Because I don't know that I really have great advice either. It still feels raw.
I texted you one night. I said, man, this sucks. This fucking sucks. We hadn't settled into a pattern and a rhythm and a routine and all that yet. And I was just like, I don't understand. It's 4 a.m. and I don't understand what's wrong. Like, we feel like we're doing everything right. Why is this kid purple screaming? And I want to go to sleep. I want to go to bed. You knew all that stuff is coming. It doesn't make it any easier in the moment, but maybe it'd be better to hear from the future that it's going to be all right. I don't know. That's not great advice, but that's.
Yeah. I feel like the real wisdom in that isn't it's going to get better. Yes, of course, you see that on the bumper sticker, like, you know, that's the aphorism to parenting. And but I think what's more important is the first statement, which was you texting me at 4 a.m, this fucking sucks. And I think that's really important to be able to acknowledge that and to do it out loud and to not feel guilty or like a failure or, geez, I must be doing something wrong because it shouldn't suck this hard. That's the wisdom, is that you're going to get to a point where you feel that fully. You feel like, this is fucked up. I hate every second of this moment right now. It doesn't feel like it's going to end. I have regret, or I have anxiety, or I'm really close to losing my shit. And to say that, and for someone to go, yeah, man, I see you, you know, or I hear you, or yes, you are right and valid 100% in those feelings, and not have some asshole who's like, oh man, you know, having kids is great. And it's like, no, there's plenty of moments where you're like, I want my money back. I don't want this anymore. You know, like,
right.
And that's normal. Like, I think that's the thing, is like, no one says that's normal. And so in the moment you feel like, wow, am I really that horrible? Like, I'm wishing my kid away in this moment. And it's like, no, dude, that's it, man. That happens. And that's normal thing. And you're not a despicable person for saying that out loud, you know? And I remember, this is going to sound horrible, but I think anybody who's been through it will go, yep. I remember similarly, Javier, for some reason, he just was not going to sleep, or he had woken up in the middle of the night and we couldn't get him back down, and we're at wit's end and we've tried everything, and it's, you know, the middle of the night. So it's not like you can call your folks or whoever you trust for advice. And we were just going crazy. The shrill sound of a baby crying in the middle of the night when you're sleep deprived. That's how people lose their shit. And I finally got him down and I collapsed down into bed next to Maris. And I said, do you ever feel like just throwing him out the window? And I was only half joking, you know? And she said, oh my God. And I thought she was going to say like, oh my God, what a horrible thing to say. Or like, oh my God, don't ever say that about our son. And she says, oh my God, I'm so glad you said that. I think about it every night. And it was like, it was this amazing thing where it's like, yes, this is a real feeling. And no, you're not seriously going to throw your kid out the window. But just to have somebody else who's supposed to love them as much as you go, hell yeah, I feel that way every night, was like, I think we both just like laughed and cried and fell asleep, you know? It was just like, thank you for saying that out loud.
I'm going to put a lock on the knife drawer for me.
Yeah, man. And that's like, it's real. And I think the sooner you can admit those kinds of feelings exist, the sooner you can, you know, you can address them and just sort of acknowledge them and give them their respect, and then, you know, both move on. And in those moments where you're just like, you know what, I'm good. I'm gonna get in the car and I'm just gonna drive away. And I may or may not return to this family. but right now I need to drive away.
Right. Your idea of yourself feels so far away in those moments, and that you want to claw back pieces of your life.
Yeah. It's maybe when it's hardest that you need it most, you know, when right. It feels like there's no way we can do this. You better figure out a way, because if you're getting to that point where you're talking about negative superlatives, like that's a pretty good indicator that you've gone a little too long without making time for each other or getting out of the house or whatever it is.
Yeah. Don't forget to take care of yourself.
What else, man? What else?
No, I mean, nothing I can think of. This is a really great conversation.
As best friends, we should probably be doing this more, like not even recording it and putting it on a podcast, but just having someone who is running parallel to you that you can count on, and who knows when you say you want to throw your kid out the window, you don't actually mean it. I think everybody needs someone in their life like that. I'm glad we had this time. it's sort of a funny thing to like formally record a conversation with somebody that you chat so informally with. But it felt really good, and I really appreciate you making time for the show. And more than that, I really appreciate your friendship, man. I'm proud to call you my friend, and I love you, man.
Likewise, man. Love you back.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Dadwell Podcast. If you were inspired by what you heard, please take a few minutes to write a quick review on iTunes. As a first season podcast, this helps a ton, and it would mean a lot to me. Dadwell is on Twitter, Instagram, Medium, and all the other relevant social networks, so visit dadwell.co to find links to all of them. While you're there, you can also subscribe to the Dadwell newsletter and even cop some fresh Dadwell merch. Additionally, you can support this project by becoming a patron via patreon.com/dadwell. That's patreon.com/dadwell. Thanks again for listening. My name is Antonio Garcia, and we'll talk again soon. Cheers.